Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is another Aftershock Monday episode, and I have a special guest today to talk about one of the hottest titles to come out from Aftershock in recent memory. He started out as a production assistant on The Daily Show, ultimately worked his way all the way up to head writer, if you can believe that. He's also been the head writer on Mystery Science Theater 3000. He's the author of several children's books, including Horse Meets Dog and Sharko and Hippo. He has his own podcast where they talk about really bad movies called The Flophouse. He's written comics previously, including 2019's Spider-Man and the X-Men, as well as the book we're about to discuss today, which is Maniac of New York from Aftershock. So it's my pleasure to welcome Elliot Kalin to the show. Elliot, thanks for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm very excited to be here. I appreciate it. I'm flattered to be asked to talk. So thank you.
Yeah, it's such an interesting journey you've had. You know, we mentioned the children's books. We mentioned the kind of the comedy writing, and for you to come out with this really kind of scary, creepy, story about a serial killer from Aftershock. I can't wait to pick your brain to see how it all came together.
Oh, my pleasure. Yeah, this is the I feel like this year is the year I finally get to come out as a horror guy. After writing everything but horror, and I've said to so many people now, I'm like, I'm a horror guy now officially. This is what I'm doing. Like, I finally get to be a horror guy. This is great after wanting to be one for so long.
Yeah, that's awesome. And you know what? One thing I forgot to mention on that intro, I should have thrown it in there. You were recently on Jeopardy too. So as a lifelong Jeopardy fan, I have to ask you, how was that experience?
It was really fun, and it was very strange because. I've been a Jeopardy fan also. Like, I watched it since I was a kid,
right.
And never always hoped I would get to be on it, but never was really sure I would be. And the process to get on it this year, this past year, because of all the things that are going on in the world that everyone knows about, I don't need to summarize them, I guess.
Right.
It was a stranger process than I would have expected. And that compounded with, Alex Trebek's health at the end of it meant that, I never quite knew when I was going to be on the show or who the host was going to be or anything. When I finally got to be on the show, it was a very strange experience because like, oh, it's finally happening. Like, it's actually right. Here after all these months and months and months of not knowing when it was going to happen. And it was really fun, but it goes by super fast. And yeah. I could not get a hang of the buzzer. And so I was very frustrated with my buzzer skills, but, I got to mention my grandma on TV, so that was the most exciting thing.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah, well, I think that, and I've heard people say that before, problems with the buzzer, it's hard, that's basically what separates the winners from losers, the people that can get, the ringing in. Because what you don't see on TV, there's a big light around the board that lights up when you can, so if you get that timing down, some people can, some people can't. But I thought you did pretty well. You had a pretty high score.
Thanks. Did okay. I came roaring back in the second round in Double Jeopardy, and my only the only thing that really bothered me was there were two things that bothered me. One, there was an X-Men question, and I did not buzz in fast enough. And the other, one of the daily doubles. I got one of the daily doubles in the Double Jeopardy round, but the other daily double, I just didn't get to answer it because I didn't get to be to choose that one.
Right.
And it was a question about Fiddler on the Roof. And I was like, no, like Fiddler on the Roof is a very important musical in my household. And so I was like, no, that was for me. I should be answering that.
Yeah, great. Like I said, I thought you did a great job. Obviously it would have been great to win, but you acquitted yourself well. So
thank you. As long as I didn't make my family ashamed. So that was the
yes, thing. There you go. Yeah. The other thing we like to do the first time we have a creator on is we always like to talk about their secret origin. So before we dive into Maniac of New York, we mentioned you being a writer, but for comics specifically, were they a part of your childhood? Did you grow up reading them? Were they always around? Were there any favorites when you were a kid?
I grew up, I remember very well, like when I was very young, I would read like Archie and stuff like that. And I was a big fan of like comic strips. Like I'd always read the Sunday comics pages.
Right.
And I was intrigued by superheroes, but for some reason I had it in my head that they were much more violent than they actually were. Mm. And so it wasn't till I was, like 11 or 12. No, it must've been between 10 and 11. Because the first comic like I ever bought with my own money was, I think it was Web of Spider-Man number 90, I think, which was the 30th anniversary issue with a hologram on the cover.
Right.
And I kind of eased into superhero comics through the Marvel Universe card sets. Like, I remember getting the Series 2 card set, and it was such a revelation to me. Because up till that point, I had assumed that superhero comics, I don't know why I thought this. I thought people were, like, ripping each other's heads off and, like, eating their eyes and stuff like that. And, like, I thought they were so – it turns out my imagination is much more violent than most other people's, even at that age. So, like, I eased into – maybe it's because at a young age I got – I sent away through a cereal box to get the first collection of old Ninja Turtles comics, and those were very violent.
Oh, right.
So I was like, oh, if this must be what Superman is like. Superman must be just tearing people's hearts out of their bodies, you know. But I remember at that age of like 10, 11, around 1992, just falling into mostly the Marvel Universe and just like loving it and being like, oh, this is a whole world that I can discover the continuity to, and really, and that eventually branching out to non-superhero comics, that, you know, and seeing what is possible with all sorts of, with the comics medium. But like, I've been now reading comics for, you know, almost 30 years, which is ridiculous. And I remember when Hellboy had his 20th anniversary, and I was like, I started reading Hellboy when he started.
When he started, I mean, yeah.
It's been 20 years I've been reading this character. That makes me feel so old. So, and the only, the thing that's, but the secret strength of it is, one, it means that like, every now and then get to write them, I feel like, oh, I'm excited about it and I know these characters. But also that now that comic superheroes and especially Marvel characters have taken over mass entertainment, I'm like, well, looks like I have the key to understanding. And so I'm the person that like all my friends' kids go to when they have questions about superheroes. And like, I can talk, like my son and I, we just finished reading the original like 66 issues of the X-Men. And now we're on to the old Hulk comics, and he can be like, what happened with and so did the Locust become a big villain? No, yeah. He didn't, Sammy. He was not a big villain, you know? So whereas I remember when I was a kid, I would talk about the characters that I was really excited about, and my dad and my mom had no idea who I was talking about. Right. They just didn't know. So it feels like the fact that that my generation has refused to give up on these things and is forcing them on our children, it's like, I can relate to my kids in a way that I wouldn't be able to otherwise. So that's a very roundabout way of talking about it. But I just always have just loved that kind of storytelling. And whenever I see like a movie or a TV show based on a comic, it always feels like it's not exactly what I want. I want the comic version of it. I want the combination of words and pictures, you know, that lets me fill in the rest in my mind.
So was that love of comics that you discovered, you know, early, you know, preteen, early teen years, and storytelling, was that part of what fueled your desire to want to become a writer?
A little bit. I'd wanted to be a writer since I was very young. I just always loved books. I've always loved reading, and I've always loved just like narrative stories and jokes and things like that. And it's has something I've had a facility with. So it was, I feel very lucky that my life has actually taken the course to do that professionally, because it's something that I'm good at. And I know there are many, many people who are good at writing who don't get the breaks that I've had, you know. But I think it definitely, it opened up the idea of a certain kind of longer sort of storytelling where most books or most movies, because I've always loved movies and I've always loved books, are fixed entities. They have a beginning and they have an end, and that's it. Mm-hmm. And the story stops when it stops, and you don't get to find out what happens afterwards. And I think what reading superhero comics in particular gave to me was this idea that like you can watch someone grow and change over a long period of time, and you can compare where they are now in the story to where they are here. Like superhero comics are one of the least realistic forms of narrative storytelling for many reasons. Like the fact that everyone either ages super slowly or doesn't age. Mm-hmm. And at any moment the universe could restart and suddenly everybody's a teenager again, you know. But that there is but just because of the way the world changes, you can watch these characters develop, and you can also infuse a lot of stuff into them. And it means that a character like Spider-Man has always been my favorite character, and he's a real kind of ethical guidepost for me. And I rely on thinking about him a lot when I have difficult decisions to make. And It's like, because so many people have infused kind of the best parts of themselves into him, you get this character who has a lot more layers than you would get from a character who is in one book and represents one thing, and then you move on from it, you know? So there, I think there was something that I picked up from that about how a character's life can keep going on and go to new places and change in different ways, even after you think the story has been told and someone else comes along and picks it. They're these big collaborative narratives, you know, and there's something very exciting about that. Of course, as a writer, I want to tell a story and have that be the story and have nobody change it ever. Even though I love it when other people change other people's stories, there's kind of a special quality to that I don't think I got from any other forms of, you know, literature or entertainment that I was looking at.
Yeah, it's a good point because, like you were saying, these characters have been around for so long, so many different writers. And I always laugh when you get periodically you'll get people that come out. I don't want any politics on my comic. It's like, have you ever read a comic? Like, you go back and look at eras of comics, and I've said this a lot recently. We're gonna look back on the era of, like, I don't know, 2017 to maybe 2021, 2022, and look at it as the era where all of a sudden all the villains in comics were fascist. You know, there's just there's this theme right out of just have these fascist regimes and whatnot. It just reflects the world around us. You know, these are written by people that are living in a real world, living in a society, and so they're going to draw on what they know. They're going to draw on kind of the angst of the zeitgeist. You know, so
exactly,
it's always been that way. So I think it's great.
The idea of writing a story that does not relate to the world around you in any way is kind of a silly idea. Yep. You know, it's something that doesn't, it kind of misunderstands what it's like to be a creative person, I guess. Mm-hmm. And even if you're writing a story that is a complete, where you're like, this is just complete escapist entertainment, I just want to let people out of the world that they're in, even that is a reaction to the world that you're in. And you're going to find things filtering into it that you just can't help. Like, there's no way you could spend there's no way you could live in America over the past 2 years and not have some amount of politics in your brain.
Right.
Unless you're that one guy that the New York Times did an article about where he was like, I'm rich, I'm going to decide to not watch or hear the news at all every day. And I'm going to wear white noise, outside noise canceling headphones all the time when I go out in public. And I was like, what a crazy life that must be. And also to be so privileged that you can be like, I'm just going to shut out the rest of the world. Yeah. I don't need to deal with it. But something I found with Maniac is that, like, you can write something that you think has one message or is about one thing, and the events of the world can affect the way it's perceived so that it changes, the interpretation changes, you know, like when I was writing it, before the pandemic. And so it was about, for me writing it, was the idea of this killer that is loose, and the problem of stopping the killer is so difficult that the people in charge decide, we just can't do it. We're just going to deal with it. Everyone just has to live with the fact that this thing could kill them. For me, that was a story about gun violence. And in the time between when I started writing it and when it was published, we had this pandemic. And so everyone was like, this is so relevant. Like, this is so relevant to the pandemic. And I'm like, I guess there's just always a bad thing going on that people throw up their hands and quit about, you know.
Yeah.
But it's even that shift imbues the book with a meaning that I couldn't have intended in the beginning because I didn't know it was going to happen, you know.
Yeah.
So there's no way to keep politics out, even if you're trying to.
Yeah, exactly. Because, like you said, you come up with an idea, and by the time it comes out, it could, you know, because the world changes, it could relate in a different way.
So
we're gonna dive into some details on Maniac in a second here, but one last question before we get to that.
I'll stop rubbing my hands in anticipation, and then I'll save that.
Well, I mean, I'm just so curious. You know, I mentioned The Daily Show, mentioned Mr. Shine's Theater 3000, but you wrote Spider-Man versus X-Men, and that was kind of your you know, first foray into the world of comics. How did you go from comedy writer to getting to write comics? You know, this medium that you loved. Kind of give us that story.
It was a real, like, I'd written a couple of a couple shorter stories before then, but it was like one of these, I've had a number of lucky breaks in my life and career where I end up in a situation through a way that I could not have planned it. And so it was literally, I was working at the Daily Show, and one of the correspondents at the time, Wyatt Cenac, who is now a superstar, but at the time he was merely a Daily Show correspondent. He was going to be a guest. He loves comic books also. He's a huge, and we would talk comics all the time. He's more of a DC Batman guy, and I'm more of a Marvel Spider-Man guy, but we would find some sort of common ground, which I guess is a real lesson for America, that even if that distance can be bridged between a Marvel zombie and a DC guy, I don't even know what the word is for DC zombies, but he was going to be a guest on a show at a comedy theater in New York called Comic Book Club. And he said, do you want to come do this with me? He's like, I don't really want to do this by myself. Do you want to come do this with me? And I said, yeah, sure. So he kind of like forced them to take me on as another guest, as a Daily Show writer. And there was a question at the end was, if you could write any story, what would it be? And I said, I've always wondered about the Inuits who had discovered Captain America frozen in a block of ice. And then Namor found them and threw the ice in the water in Avengers number 4 or whatever it was. Like, what happened to them? Like, their story was never told. And it's a crazy thing to, one, find a frozen guy that you decide is a god, and then have some other, like, Olympian figure come in and hurl your god into the ocean, and it just disappears.
Right.
And then it's not like they don't live in another century. Like, eventually they're going to see on TV that, or hear on the radio that Captain America is around and be like, oh, that's what that was about.
That's who that was. Yeah.
So what was it like for them and for their children, you know? And in the audience were some people from Marvel, and I'm trying to remember, the editor I was working with was Tom Brennan, who was at Marvel for a while and now works in the mayor's office in New York. I don't remember if he was in the audience or not. I think he was, but they were like, oh, we're doing an anthology series. Would you want to write that story? And I was like, yeah, sure, definitely. And that writing that led to kind of a couple other short stories. There was a humor book that Wyatt and I wrote some stuff for. And then they asked me to write a Wolverine annual. And I guess they liked that enough that the editors there came to me and they were like, hey, would you want to write a Spider-Man book? Definitely. Do you want to write an X-Men book? Yeah, of course. Okay, here's a Spider-Man and X-Men book. Here's the thing. Wolverine's going to die. The problem is, before he dies, he tells Spider-Man to go teach a class at his school. And I'm like, okay. And he's like, and they're like, and you just have to figure out why he's doing it. And I was like, okay. So, and they gave me surprisingly free rein on it. And I really got to, I made a newbie mistake in that I tried to pack as much story as I could into the book. And at times it's a little overloaded. But I was like, I don't know when I'm going to get a chance to do this again. So I'm going to write as many stories in these 6 issues as I can. I want to always be combining Spider-Man villains and X-Men villains, and have it be a little bit of a referendum for me on Spider-Man's ethic, which I relate to completely, is if you have power, you have a responsibility to use that power to help other people. But and at that point, the X-Men had become this group that kind of like sat around their house waiting for people to attack them, you know, not to badmouth current work, but like the current X-Men run is kind of that, but bigger, where it's like, well, we're all going to go to our own country now and people attack us every now and then. But but at the same time, so Spider-Man sees the X-Men as abdicating their responsibility to help people. But the X-Men they're an oppressed minority, essentially. Like, they are under attack in the way that, it's like Spider-Man's under attack from bad guys from J. Jonah Jameson, but if he takes off his mask, he's fine.
He's fine, yeah.
Nobody's ever going to go after him. So the X-Men, Spider-Man is a guy with a certain privilege they don't have who is telling them how to live their lives. And I wanted to like not make the whole story about that, but to have those philosophies kind of like bumping heads every now and then until they could both learn a little bit about each other, you know? And it was a lot to take on in 6 issues. And since I'm not Neil Gaiman or Alan Moore or Grant Morrison, I overloaded it, but it was super fun to read and it was super fun to write. And one panel from it, people still read. So that's pretty good. So, but that's basically how it happened, was like lucking into being in the situation where I was asked in front of an audience, what story would you like to write? And someone from Marvel being there and being like, hey, yeah, you can write that story. You know,
yeah, that's so cool. I'm gonna have to go hunt that down. I didn't realize you'd written that. Cause yeah, I'm intrigued. I want to know what happened to the natives that discovered Captain America. I did love your Spider-Man versus X-Men. Oh, you're right. It is bursting at the seams, but that's kind of some of the fun of it.
That's a little bit my personality too. With Maniac, one of the challenges for me was I was like, okay, let's not try to cram an entire story into the first issue. Like, let's take some time to tell it so that it can breathe a little bit and we'll like get to know these people. But that Captain America story was in a book called Age of Heroes. I think it was number 4, but I'm not sure. But it was that dates when it was, because it was when Marvel was briefly having that thing called Age of Heroes that was after Civil War, I think.
Yeah.
I can't remember. They've had so many events since then that I have trouble keeping track of them.
Well, let's dive into Maniac of New York, the Aftershock title. It went, first of all, congratulations on it selling out and going to a second printing. That's fantastic.
Thank you. I think it's the only thing I've ever done that has had a second printing so far. So I was like, this is amazing.
That's awesome. And you've talked about it a little bit briefly, but if any of our listeners aren't familiar with kind of the elevator pitch, let them know, like, what's the consensus of the story if you boil it down?
So the way I was thinking about it for a while, and this is basically like, if instead of The Wire being about drugs in Baltimore, it was about New York and us, and basically Jason, you know, a Jason type killer. So when I was a kid, I was always disappointed in Jason Takes Manhattan. And I was like, they're not taking enough advantage of a kind of unkillable killer just roaming around this city that, like, I live in LA now, but I grew up in New Jersey, right outside of New York. And I lived in New York for about 17, 18 years. Like, it's a city I really love. And that means, of course, that I want to see someone destroying it, you know,
right,
and think about how cool that would be. But the idea is, about 4 years ago, this masked, unkillable, unstoppable serial monster appeared and killed a lot of people and started roaming New York, taking victims. And everyone in the government declared, we'll never let this happen again. This is horrible. No stone will be left unturned. We will stop this. And then it turned out, how do you stop an unstoppable killer? You cannot. He's unstoppable. He's just going to roam around, and he has the consciousness of an animal. So it's not like you can reason with him. You're not going to put him on, you can't catch him. If you shoot him, he just keeps walking by. So it's so difficult that they just throw up their hands and say, like, this is not a problem that we're going to try to solve anymore. We're just going to let it happen. And so now, 4 years later, it's set in 2020 or 2021. I can't remember if I thought well enough ahead to set it in 2021 instead of the year I was writing it, or the year I finished writing it. But it's just a fact of life. And like on New York One, the local New York station that gives you the rail and road traffic report, they give you a Harry tracker. Is it because it's called, they've named him Harry the Maniac or Maniac Harry. They give you a Harry tracker that tells you he's been in this neighborhood, so maybe to stay out of that neighborhood right now. Like, the best you can do is hope to stay away from him. And we're introduced to two characters. I knew yesterday, elevator pitch is totally not. But Gina Green, who's the new mayor's aide in charge of what's called the Maniac Task Force, which at this point is basically just someone they can blame when the maniac does bad stuff. But she actually wants to try to stop him when nobody else is trying to. And she reaches out to an NYPD detective, Zelda Pettibone, who has been put on the maniac beat as punishment for something, basically, that we don't, as of the first issue, we don't know what that is. But there are two people who, one of them is burnt out and cynical. The other one is very eager to actually stop this monster for her own reasons. And they're going to try to work together to see if there's anything they can do. And by the end of the first issue, there's like a false alarm. They think the maniac's been sighted. It turns out it was just somebody in a welder's mask. So they're like, what are we even doing? Like, why are we even trying this? And by the end of the issue, Maniac Harry is about to step onto a subway train. And I've long had a real, a real fear of what can happen to you on a subway train when you're between stations and the doors are closed and you're just trapped there. So we're going to see that nightmare, basically, of like these people stuck on a train while this monster that they cannot defend themselves against is roaming from end to end. Telling you, the shortest version is basically like, if you had a slasher killer that most of the city has decided is just something we're going to have to live with, and how the two people who have decided maybe we don't need to live with anymore are going to try to change that situation.
Yeah. And it's great. So, you know, we meet him in the first couple of pages, we see him go nuts at, you know, the ball dropping on New Year's Eve. You know, that's kind of the first event that, like you said, sparks this, yeah, we're going to stop him, never again, we won't forget the victims and blah, blah, blah. and then to turn the page and have it him just be part of the, like, the, you know, road and rail report, this innocuous thing, like, eh, it's no big deal. And we cited Harry, you know, I'm like, wait, what? It was brilliant. It was brilliantly done. I loved that, you know, you could just right away. And to your point earlier about the way we've just given up on certain things, you know, we can't control the pandemic, we'll just live with it. All of a sudden it was like, well, yeah, I could see him doing that, you know, maybe not realistic, maybe not realistic in, you know, 20, 30 years ago, but now all of a sudden it's like, yeah. And the other part of it, this isn't expressly presented, but you kind of hint at it. This idea that rather than fix it, everybody's just going to use it as like a political tool and blame, you know, like the mayor's going to blame the governor and the governor's going to blame the mayor. And it's this, you know, and they're just passing the buck around. And now it's going to be, well, we'll bring Gina in, this true believer, and we'll blame her.
Yeah.
So, and did you always plan on having that political aspect in it?
Oh, very much so. Yeah. It's something that I love. I'm a big politics guy, and like working at the Daily Show I was there for like 13 years, you know, and it's still something that the news I look at is still political news. Like there are times when I look at the New York Times and I'm like, oh yeah, there's things that happen that aren't political. Like I need to remember that. I always wanted to look at how a system kind of fails to deal with a difficult problem. There's a thing that it feels like there's a real feeling in the country, and there has been for a while. And like I said, when I started writing this, it was about gun violence, but now it's somewhat, it became the feeling about masks, where it was a certain section of the country saying, it is easier for you to die than for me to change anything about the way I live. Like, this is inconvenient for me, so I'm just going to have to let you die. And what are you going to do? And that's something that feels very current, but it's kind of always been around. I was part of a project last year. I was doing a podcast called I Claudius about the TV show I Claudius. And there were lines in that show and scenes in that show where I was like, this is kind of on the nose about Trump. Like, I Claudius, you could be a little bit more, like a little bit less blunt. But that show's from 1976. It's based on a book from the 1930s, which is based on history from 2000 years ago. Like, the same things just kind of keep happening in human life, because people's brains don't really change. And so I always wanted to look at it that way. And I always want to tell a story about, I've always been fixated on this idea of like a killer you cannot stop. You know, the police can go after him, but what happens if he kills all the police? Like, how do you deal with something like that? And it felt like that could be a metaphor for those types of failings. And that often the people who suggest solutions to those problems are the ones who get dumped on, you know, because it's easier to live with the problem than it is to try to fix it. And I was thinking about this idea. I've been thinking about it for years, but I remember seeing the movie Shin Godzilla, the last like Japanese Godzilla movie, which is very similar in some ways, where it's treating Godzilla like a public health crisis, you know, or which I think was a reaction to the Fukushima nuclear event, a catastrophe. And like their way of using that as a metaphor for it and treating Godzilla like, well, how would the government respond to this, was very like heartening to me. It was like, oh, okay, other people are thinking this way. Okay, good. Like this is not a crazy idea. Although for a while, anyone I described this idea to, they were like, that's a crazy idea, like this. unfortunately, reality has borne me out. So I have the bittersweet reward of being able to say, see, I told you, people can be blind to terrible things happening. Oh, what a bad, I would so rather be wrong.
Yeah, well, I think part of the reason people reacted that way and initially heard it is, you know, with the politics and with this idea of just letting a bad thing happen, it is so much more realistic to do it in terms of, you know, just letting the fallout of a natural disaster and not bothering to clean it up, or a pandemic like we're going through right now. When you start talking about this horror icon, you know, this kind of analog for a Jason or a Freddy to come in, well, it's just one guy. Why can't we just, you know, and you mentioned doing it out of a love of horror. I mean, was that part of your kind of formative years as well? A love of kind of slasher films and classic horror as well?
Similar to superhero comics. When I was young, I was very afraid of the idea of that stuff. And it was like, and was very And it wasn't until I got, again, I was a teenager and I started watching those movies that were like, oh, okay, these are violent, but they're not as bad as I was imagining, because apparently I'm a monster who imagines hard, terrifying things. But really loving the feeling of, yeah, that feeling of, I like to read and watch things that scare me, you know. And it's very funny. My wife hates scary stuff, and we have two sons, and one of my sons hates scary things and the other one likes them a lot. And so it really feels like it's a thing that's born in you, that whether fear leads to pleasure in some way or not. And there's definitely a line that I get to where if I'm watching a movie that is just torturing characters, the taste goes away. You know, I don't like it as much, but there's some kind of safe fear that is fun for me in the way that real fear is of actual things is not fun.
Right.
And how I'm very afraid of certain types of like public interactions with strangers, but the idea of a little bit like watching a monster tear people's heads off, I'm like, all right, okay, yeah, I'll watch that. You know, but there's a certain type of the fear of like never feeling safe is something that I find really fascinating. And like I really loved the movie It Follows from a few years ago. And I remember I was leaving The Daily Show at the time I saw that. And it was watching that movie that helped me make that decision. Cause I was like, yeah, there are things out there that movie really touched me on a deep level. And I was like, I'm not gonna be able to do that in topical comedy the same way. So I want to try other things. But the idea in that movie of there's just a thing that comes after you and it never stops. Like you can get far away from it, but it never stops. And you can try to pass it on to another person, but eventually it's going to come back to you. And how that is essentially the situation everybody lives in. You know, we're not all being chased by a monster, but we're all going to die eventually. And seeing how that movie took a very big existential fear and communicated as a very specific, like monster-based fear was very exciting to me. So I've always had a taste for that kind of stuff. And with Maniac, it was like, oh, I'm finally getting to do that kind of thing. This is great. But of course, there's still gonna be jokes in it because like, I can't not, it's impossible. There's no way for me not to have jokes in it, so.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that brings a levity and a realism to it because, you know, oftentimes that's how we deal with stress and things that are, you know, feeling out of control is to, you know, kind of try to lighten the mood. The other thing that I immediately was struck by in the first issue, and you know, you mentioned living in, you know, growing up next to New York and then living in New York. New York itself, you know, we talked about Gina, we talked about Zelda. New York itself is its own character. So that must have been, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but that must have been relatively easy for you to do, being kind of a New Yorker yourself, right? The idea that, hey, this setting is its own sort of living, breathing being.
Somewhat. There's definitely like there are parts of the city I know better than others. New York is, there are other cities, I'm sure that like, you know, Beijing is probably like this and like Moscow is probably like this. These cities that are so big, you can't really hold them all in your mind at right. once, as opposed to a city like Boston, where it's like, yeah, I got room for five or six Bostons in my mind. It's a small, you know, it's a small city, but this is a little New York, anti-Boston here. I've been away from New York for a couple years now. And especially, you know, I started writing this at the end of 2019. And especially while I was writing the last few issues, I hadn't been to New York in a while. And I haven't been able to go back there for over a year. And so there's part of me that worries that I like am working off of old fumes, that like I'm remembering that I'm writing the New York of like 2013, you know, as opposed to New York of 2020. But it's definitely a place that I feel a comfort level with. And there's more than anything else, like New York is I think more than any other city, except maybe Paris possibly, or Tokyo, New York is like an imagined city that exists in people's minds. Cause there's mm-hmm. so many movies and TV shows set in New York. There's so many stories set in New York. And like I was talking about Marvel Comics, like most, except for the Hulk stomping around the Southwest, for most of my reading history, New York has been the place that superheroes live and not really right. anywhere else, which is such a New York view of the world that it's like, well, yeah, if you're a superhero, you're going to go to New York. Like that's the big thing. Like as a kid growing up, New York was like, in my mind, it was like, oh, that's where grownups go to live. Like if you're a grown-up, you live there. And the way I would see New York in like Ghostbusters or like Gremlins 2 or things like that was very was like a, even though I knew New York, I went in frequently because I had family that lived there. That was still like a concept in my mind that felt kind of super real, like above reality. There's a part of me that looks at the Empire State Building and it's like, I wish I could have been here when that gorilla was climbing up it, even though I know that didn't really happen.
Right.
But it still feels like it happened. And so to a certain extent, I think I'm muddling kind of like that dream New York that we know from movies and TV shows with my real experiences of waiting on the subway at New York. And like in a later issue, there's a short scene at the Museum of Natural History in a section of the museum that people don't usually visit very much, where that like, I just know because I used to spend days at that museum. And so it was fun for me as someone who wasn't in New York anymore to like walk through my memory feelings of the city. But if I get to do a second storyline, I really want to do one in the Bronx, and the Bronx is a part of the city I don't know super well. Mm. And like, I'm going to have to do some research for it. And I'm desperately afraid that I'm going to like screw it up and not do it right. And so I'm very afraid of it. And that fear is exciting to me too, because the parts of New York I know best, like I don't really want to see a maniac walking around in Park Slope, Brooklyn. That doesn't seem that exciting to me. Right. Although now that I think about it, actually, there's a pretty good story in that. Maybe I'll do that at some point too.
The other thing that you really lucked out on is kind of the mood that is set by the visuals. So the artist on the book, Andrew Moody, who I've met several times, and he's a spectacular artist. He is kind of capturing this feel of the city and this gritty, scary story, suspenseful story that you're trying to tell. So has the collaboration, did you guys click right away? Was there some back and forth? How have you found the collaboration to be?
I've really loved working with him. He's like, I love the look of what he's doing. And it has sort of it feels like it gets at some of that dream New York feel. The way he uses color, it feels like that, the haze that you see in movies where like, and in real life too, but it's gross in real life, but it's cool in movies, of like the steam coming out of sewer grates and things like that. And I'm playing very much off of, in some ways, the New York movies of the 70s and the early 80s. And I feel like his art has the grit in that. And like, and I love his character designs. Like I really love the way that he designed Harry, and that he designed the non-monster characters. And every now and then there's a back and forth where it's like, oh, actually, could you do this? Because I want to make sure this is super clear, because two issues from now, I'm going to call back to this thing. Right. But for the most part, I give him the script and then he draws it and I'm like, this looks gorgeous. And then he paints it and I'm like, yeah, now it looks even better. And so like, it's been I really love working with him. It's been a really fantastic collaboration. We got to work together once before a long time ago on a short story in an American Vampire anthology book and on that too, it's just like, I feel like we work together well. And so another reason I hope we get to do another storyline is the stuff that I'm thinking about, I want to see Andrea draw it. Like I want to see how he's going to make it look, you know? And he just totally gets, just right from the beginning, he totally got like the horror stuff. And I get emails from him where I'm like, I'll send the script and he's just emailed me back all in caps, like sick. Like, oh, this is hard. Like he's started, like, I'll be like, I want to make sure we can see that this person's leg has been cut off or whatever. And he's like, oh, I love it. Like gross. So
that's awesome. When you took the pitch to Aftershock, did they give you a list of artists, or did they say, hey, we think Andrew would be perfect for this?
There were a couple different artists that they asked me my opinion on, but they were really, but that was like the editor on the book, Mike Martz, he was like, but this is the guy that we should have do it. And I was like, yeah, I think so too. And like, it was like, here are a couple options, but here's the like, but then you like push forward the option that you,
right,
that you really think is right for it. And it was, and I think he was right. Like it was the right choice for it. I think it gets the, like, I think if the art was too real looking, it would be, cause his art looks real, but it still has that kind of like, it's still abstracted in some ways. Mm-hmm. And if it was too real, I think it might come off as almost like too ridiculous in some way, because the concept to a certain extent is somewhat ridiculous, because he's a monster, but he also wears like pants and a jacket, you know, and he has a, there's a line in a, in the second issue where a person's like, he owns an axe for God's sake. Like they, but if it was too, but if at the same time, if it was too cartoony, if it was too stylized, I would worry that it wouldn't have the weight that it has here. Like as much as I want it to be a fun read, I also want it to feel like when Harry kills somebody, like that's a person who died, you know? Right. And I don't want it to just be as, even though the body count is going to be enormous, like it's going to be ridiculously enormous. There's just going to be blood everywhere. I do want it to feel like, oh, these are people that, that in the, in my fictional world of this comic, these are people who were on their way somewhere or in the middle of something, or they had a life before they got killed. And if they hadn't been killed, they would have a life that went on. They're not just, even though they function as fodder for Harry, hopefully they don't feel like just fodder for Harry, you know?
Yeah. And I think you're right. I think Andrew, he's straddling that balance really well. You go too realistic, it feels like, you know, the, you know, a slasher horror flick. And if you go too, you know, abstract, then it's just fantastical. But he's right there in kind of the sweet spot where you're getting the suspense, you know, and that's scary. But it's not, you know, it's not gratuitous or anything like that. And to just a quick word about Mike Marks. I mean, you can go a long way in comics just by listening to what Mike says. I mean, he's great. I mean, he's got so much experience, and yeah, he definitely makes the right call. And I kind of on that note, I wanted to ask you about taking this to Aftershock. I mean, were you familiar with them? Did you realize how great a fit this story was going to be for them? Because I mean, I think you ended up at the perfect publisher for this story.
Oh, very much so. I was only a little aware of them, and my managers, I'm with a management firm called Artist First. They're my managers. They said, we want to introduce you to Aftershock so that if you have things that you want to do in comics, they're a place that we think you should do them. And I met with Lee, that head of the company. Mm-hmm. And I mentioned this idea to him. It was an idea that like, I've been trying to figure out the form for it for a long time. Like at one point I was like, is this like a fake oral history novel? Is this like, should I write a TV pilot? Should I write a feature script of it? Like, how do I get this story in a form? And I mentioned it to him and he was like, yeah, like write up a proposal for that, write up a pitch for that. And I knew that they have a real, not all their stuff is horror, but everything has a certain like visceral, like real, like intense feel to it. You know, they have a real house style in terms of how like, aggressive is the wrong word, but like when I read an Aftershock book, I'm like, but like afterwards I have to like sit down and like take a breath, you know, and be like, oh, okay. Like that was an intense experience. And so it felt like they were really, yeah, like a fantastic fit. And they, since they're not, it feels like they're not beholden to anyone else's idea of what they put out. It's only their idea of what they put out. And so they were like, yeah, do it. And they were very good with me about like, you know, not laying any strictures to me about like, this is how we want you to structure it. This is how we want the story to go. This is what we like, no, this isn't what we're doing. They were like, okay, tell your story. And that was very exciting. So I feel like, yeah, this was the fit that was right for this one. And the story that is out is the story I wanted to tell without any compromises, you know?
Yeah, well, you used a word there, and I think it's the perfect word to describe their titles. They all have an intensity to them, you know, whether they lean more toward horror or more toward science fiction, you know. Yeah, there's just there's an intensity to the storytelling, and I every creator that I've talked to that's worked over there has loved the experience, and so it's with that level of kind of interaction between a creator and a publisher, you get to let your passion show, and when you're having fun as a creator, and you're, you know, passionate about the story you're telling, that comes through in the pages that you're having fun, and it makes for a better end product, I think.
Yeah, I definitely, I'm trying to figure out what to pitch them next. I pitched something to them that they were like, this is not quite for us afterwards. And I looked at it, I was like, this is not intense enough. This is not an Aftershock book. So I need to like find the next thing, because I really want to do another book with them and figure out what the right fit is, you know, to get that, it's exciting to be working with a company where they're like, yeah, we want, they didn't say this to me, but it feels like part of the part of the remit is like, well, we want each book to feel like you're punching the reader in the face,
right,
with the story, and the reader can't, they read, nobody can read the book and just be like, oh, okay, yeah, that was that book. Like, you're going to have a reaction to it, which is exciting.
Yeah, and it goes back to that the slogan they had last year, which was "Read dangerously." You know,
yeah,
you want those kind of intense stories. Going back to your collaboration with Andrew, one thing I forgot to ask you. You mentioned him nailing the designs of characters. So did you give him any notes on character design? Was there a back and forth there, or did you just say, you know, here's the story, let's see what you come up with?
It was not with Harry, it was like he knew it was a masked kind of slasher, and he had a few different designs that he came up with, like different types of mask designs, different types of clothing designs. And it was a little bit of like, let's try this. Let's try these pants with that mask. You know, let's try these elements together. And that was a very collaborative process. It was him working off of not really much of a description other than it's a slasher with a mask, and figuring out what elements he thinks communicated that, and then us figuring out which ones I think worked best. With the other characters, with Gina and with Zelda, it was like there were, again, pretty like basic descriptions, not very detailed. Mm-hmm. And he did a great job, I think, of basically designing the faces for them that fit the way that that the characters needed to look, you know. Mm-hmm. That even the characters feel like the people that they're supposed to be. And I think I might have asked him, he sent like a design of Zelda, and I think I might have said like, could she have shorter hair or something like that? And that was about it, you know. Otherwise, he you know, he knows what he's doing so well that I don't want to step in and be like, no. This, like, here's a photograph of somebody that it needs to look like or something like that, you know. Part of the fun of it was seeing him. There's a character in the second issue who is a writer who's like a real who's a real like a successful jerk, and seeing the design that he came back with for him, and I was like, yep, that's good. That like that looks like this smug guy, you know. So yeah. He's got such a talent for communicating character through face, you know, communicating personality through the way a person's face is shaped and their expressions. And that's for a book like this that is about realish people in a crazy situation, that's enormously necessary, you know.
Yeah, and it's good advice for you know, for creators who, you know, don't have a huge body of work, a lot of experience. Man, trust your artist. Mm-hmm. they know what they're doing, especially when you have somebody who's been around for as long as Andre has. You mentioned, you know, hoping to get to do a second volume because you have specific things you'd put in there that, you know, having written the first one, not knowing Andrea was your artist. Anything that you changed in the, like, once you found out Andrea was your artist, anything you changed in the first volume? Well, let me just tweak this because I know Andrea can really nail that.
Not too much, but because he can handle just about anything. So there was that, like, there wasn't anything that I felt I needed to. I think there's I kind of want to, in the next storyline, I may try to like take advantage of that ability with faces, you know, more. There's a lot of, so this storyline, much of it involves Harry on this subway train. And there's a lot of, kind of train car based, you know, compositions.
Right.
And in the next one, there'd be a slightly larger variety of set, like different settings, basically. And I want to take advantage of like, who are the people that you find in those places?
Right.
And what are the different ways that that Andrea can kind of choreograph Harry doing stuff in those settings? You know, this was not part of what I was thinking of that storyline, but I mentioned some recently. I was like, I don't want the book to just be like, Harry gets loose in the Met, and now he's killing people in front of all these like Greek statues. But then after thinking about it, I was like, wait a minute, I really want to see Andrea drawing that though. Like, now, like, I got to figure out a reason that now to take Harry to the Met and have like, cause I could just to see what he could do with like people being killed in the ancient Roman wing and like blood spattering on, you know, ancient statues and things like that I know he could do something really amazing with that. So now I have to figure out what to do with it.
Well, maybe it's something for the trade. You get Andrew and other artists too. Hey, how about a pinup of Harry killing people here or here at the Bronx Zoo? That kind of thing would be funny.
Oh, I definitely, yeah, the Bronx Zoo was something I was thinking about. Like, there's so many New York locations that are there, but so many like, iconic locations. And this was when I was a kid. That my issue with Jason Takes Manhattan was I was like, there's so much in New York. Like yeah. You got like there's so many places that I know so well just from seeing them. And then there are parts of New York, like this room in the Natural History Museum that are like important to me, you know, right. That I want to see Harry in. And like, there's just so much. Yeah. I feel like there's like almost unlimited potential. And now I want to see, yeah, Harry pinup book where it's like, okay. Like he's it. Yeah. He's in that little park on Gramercy Park that you need a key to get into, but like yep. He somehow got into it. He's at LaGuardia. Like he's about to get on a plane. They got to stop him. He's
you're right. I've only been to New York a handful of times. I'm Coney Island, you know. Rockefeller Center. I mean, you could just go on and on. People are skating around the big Christmas tree and he's slicing them up.
Yeah, exactly. There's so much possibility there. And he's in Washington Square Park. And there's just, you know, like now I'm just thinking of places that I used to live near. But now I can't get the Met out of my head. The idea of like, there's a room in the Metropolitan Museum with this ancient Egyptian temple called the Temple of Dendur that's surrounded by water. That there's mm-hmm. The idea of like bodies just kind of floating face down in that. And he's just standing in the entryway of this like ancient temple that's, now, but the thing is, like, you get a cool image in your head, and then it's like, but I don't want to tell a story that's just about him murdering people. Like, right. What is this about that I can justify him doing, that I can justify to myself that I'm writing a story about him murdering people? But there's so much, like, he's on the Brooklyn Bridge, he's on the, you know, he's in the sewers, there's so much to New York that I feel like we've, because it's a city that's so well covered in narrative that you don't have to spend time explaining the place, you know, mm-hmm. People feel like they know it, you know? I'd need probably 600 issues to like, until I even started feeling like I was exhausting it, you know?
But, well, in the back of the first issue, you have the little map of the incidents and how many people. So yeah, you could go back to the ones he's already done. And you know, at least in our minds, we can imagine this one happened here, this one happened there, what have you. Mm-hmm. So again, Elliot, thank you so much for joining me. It's been great to chat with you about this. The first issue was great. Again, congratulations on selling out and going to a second printing. Second issue drops this Wednesday, everybody, March 10th. So be sure you pick it up. Look for the second printing as well. Anything in the second issue that you're really excited to hear fans' reactions to?
Yes, but I don't want to say what it is, but I feel like the thing that I'm curious about people's reactions to the most is kind of like, as we learn more about Zelda and Gina kind of, and where, what happened with them and where they're from. I'm curious to see how people, respond to that, you know, but then there's also, there's like that the scene with this writer that I'm talking about, they go for information, they go to meet with this guy who wrote a book about what they call Bloody New Year, mm-hmm. when Harry first appeared in Times Square during on New Year's Day, and like just how I'm curious what people take from that. It's the weird thing of like I wanted to do this book originally because I wanted to write scenes of a guy murdering people all over New York. And I had to come up with the story to justify that to myself. But now the parts of the story that are the most interesting to me are who the other people that are in it and those characters. And so part of the exciting thing to me is like, which characters are people going to glom onto and which are they not? And which of them may have enough of a connection with the audience that like that I can take them into another story with me and have people deal with that so that it's not because even though the maniac is the title character, he's not, he's the thing that everyone's life is being distorted by, but right. Those lives are what they're the characters, you know, although at some point, perhaps I'll get to tell where the maniac came from and all that. We'll see. There's too much to tell in one storyline, you know? So I guess go tell Aftershock that you need more maniac, you know?
Well, the reception for the first issue seemed to, you know, really kind of hit. So that must've been real gratifying for you.
For sure. It's something, it's always exciting when something that you're really into, that you create, other people react to, and in the way that you want them to react to it. And like, the thing I would compare it to the most is in Spider-Man, the X-Men, the comic that I wrote for Marvel, there's this one panel where Spider-Man's talking to Sauron. And he says, with this technology you have, you could cure cancer. And you're using it to turn people into dinosaurs. And Sauron says, I don't want to cure cancer. I want to turn people into dinosaurs. And writing that and being like, I hope someone else finds that as funny as I do. And then seeing that as something that people really responded to. It's just like, it's gratifying because it's like, oh, okay, good. I know what I'm doing. Okay. Like I'm not an imposter. I'm not fooling anybody. So to see people respond to this idea that, again, it's been living in my head in one form or another for years, you know, mm-hmm. to finally get it out in the world and have people reacting to it so positively is hugely rewarding. And I'm thankful to everybody who picked it up. Like, I'm not a name that can sell a book just on my name yet, maybe. And it's not a pre-existing character, you know, it's from a publisher that is a great publisher, but is not, you know, one of the ones that non-comics people necessarily might know. Like, to have it hit this way when what they're responding to is the concept and the story is really exciting, you know, and the art.
Yeah. And it's a spectacular story. And I look forward to more comic work from you in the future. So as we're closing up here, anything else that you're working on, anything that you want to share or give a shout out to our listeners?
I'll promote what other things I have going on. I mean, the funny thing is aside from writing for TV, my other main sideline besides Maniac is writing children's picture books. And I have two picture books, Horse Meets Dog and Charco and Hippo. And Charco and Hippo just came out last year, also with an artist named Andrea, but a different Andrea. It's Andrea Tsurumi. And Horse Meets Dog was with an artist named Tim Miller. And if you have a child or know a child, those are just very silly books about misunderstandings and are, I think, funny, and they're super fun reads, and they are not at all violent or involving murder or anything like that. And last year I was very lucky to write for a new Fox animated show called Housebroken. That's about animals that pets in a pet therapy group. And it was, and I think the show's coming out really great. And I think it's supposed to come out in the spring, but I'm not sure, but keep an eye out for that. If you like funny stuff, that's a real funny show. And I know because I've seen it, but you guys haven't seen it yet. So keep a lookout for Housebroken. And if you know a child or feel like a child sometimes, Horse Meets Dog and Shark and Hippo, please pick them up at your local independent bookstore. I would appreciate it. And of course, there's my podcast, The Flophouse, but it's nonsense. Like, you know, it's just me and my friends, Stuart and Dan, talking nonsense. So if you like nonsense, check out The Flophouse. But if you're not into nonsense, I totally understand.
And where can people follow you on social media so they know when things like Housebroken and other future comic work is coming out? Where should they follow you?
That's a great idea. I'm at Elliot Kalin, just my name with no embellishments, on Twitter. And you will find me there either promoting my things, occasionally being frustrated about politics. So I'm trying to limit my political tweeting because all it does is make me mad, and it doesn't help anybody.
Right.
And occasionally saying very stupid jokes. So that's at Elliot Kalin on Twitter. It's my chosen social media platform.
Great. And I'll put links to Elliot's Twitter in the show notes, everybody. So you can go, if you're having trouble finding him, you can go click there and follow him. So again, Elliot, thanks for joining me. It's been a blast talking to you. Love the series, and I can't wait to read more.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me. It's been great talking. And yeah, I hope your audience has enjoyed it, and that if they haven't checked out Maniac of New York, please do. I think it's a good book, and I'm an objective judge of the things that I've written. So I think go for it. But thank you so much for letting me talk about it. It's been super fun.
All right, listeners, to you, I'll offer my thanks as well for joining us, for supporting us, and for listening. As always, we'll talk to you next time.
You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.